Welcome to the Untoxicated Podcast.
Well, I'm Sherry Salas, and that was my husband, Matt.
We have questions about the impact of alcohol and addiction on relationships.
If you have those kinds of questions, too, you're in the right place.
Here we go. Sherry, I know your favorite part about the fact that we are promoting this alcoholic intimacy survey right now is that right off the top of every podcast episode, we get to talk about sex, which I know sometimes you're like, are we ever going to get around to talking about sex on these podcasts?
I know. I wish we did more of that.
Right off the top. Mm-hmm. We've had a great, outcome.
Response.
Response. That's the word. Great response to the survey that we've been asking people to help us with. But we are not at our goal yet. And so we could definitely use some more respondents. So want to thank those of you who have already taken the alcoholic intimacy survey. And for those of you who have not had a chance yet, you can go to alcoholicintimacysurvey.org and read all about the details. You took it, Sherry.
I did.
How was it?
It was easy. I mean, I guess easy is a little bit of a exaggeration. It was not hard. It was mostly like number rate. Well, I mean, but you had to think.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, and it could bring up some memories. So
sure.
It could, but it wasn't hard because there was a number scale. There were multiple choices. There wasn't a lot of typing and, explaining situations verbally. So
yeah, I think there
that
are...
helped a lot. Also, I'm a terrible typist, so...
So, I think there are three open-ended, what we would call qualitative questions, mm-hmm. where people have the chance to share in sentence form. Did you type anything? Or were you just N/A?
No. I didn't even know you put a slash in between.
N-O-Y-B.
None of your old business. I think I just had, like, short, quick answers, like I would put on a survey from, like, Einstein Bagel. You know, why didn't you enjoy your customer service, better?
Why didn't enjoy your sexual experience better?
Yeah. Well, my server wasn't very nice.
Customer service problems. That's how you can answer the qualitative questions. That's great.
Yeah, they were just kind of, like, real quick, short sentences.
Well, thank you for taking the survey, Sherry.
Yeah.
And let me assure our listeners, first of all, we have no way of even knowing who you are because we don't ask for any of that kind of information. We don't ask for, anything that could, not only not just your name, but we don't ask for anything that could clue us into who is responding what. We don't want to know who responds what. We want it to be anonymous in that way. And so you don't have to worry about me following up with you and asking you how you answered the qualitative questions.
Are you worried that I'm hiding a bunch of stuff from you?
No, I just feel like you get the Spanish Inquisition far more than anyone else will, so I don't want anyone else to be worried.
Yeah.
We won't have any way to track you.
We won't.
So again, if you're interested in taking it, we really would appreciate it. AlcoholicIntimacySurvey.org. We're going to read a listener question. This listener question ties in closely with the rest of what we want to talk about. So this is going to be one of those episodes where distinguishing between the listener question and the rest of the topic is pretty much impossible. Before we read the listener question, I want to just encourage people to keep sending those in. We love reading and getting your emails. Even if we don't get a chance to work the listener question into an episode, we really, really appreciate it. We always respond, maybe not in great detail, but we always respond and let people know what we're thinking about the potential for using their question. And it's really helpful if, when you send in the listener question, if you put the words listener question in the subject line, helps us sort and organize. And, that's what this podcast is all about, you helping us be organized. Thank you, listeners.
And take the survey.
Is there anything else you can do for us? I'd like a cup of coffee, actually.
Oh, well. I'll enjoy mine.
Yeah.
I won't share. You are smarter than me.
So our listener question for today. My husband is a veteran who experienced significant combat polytrauma, brain, body, mental, and physical. I have been the caregiver and advocate through it all, which included many surgeries, she said. She talks about how he has been self-medicating with alcohol since 2017. They have two young kids. She feels like a solo parent. He has been to, plural, more than one, detoxes and rehabs. She says that the hiding and the lying, when he starts drinking again after a detox and rehab, there's hiding and lying. And very importantly, he blames her for the deterioration of the marriage. So this question came in kind of multiple paragraph form, so I'm just kind of summarizing. But, you know, she gets more distant. She detaches emotionally. She pulls back because of the behavior she's experiencing and not feeling close and comfortable and safe in her relationship. And then he blames her for the deterioration of the marriage, something you and I can definitely relate to. Pardon me. She says, I don't want a divorce. I want my person back. Do they ever come back? Is walking away the only way to get them back? Mm. Such a painful, powerful experience. I can't help but think about the episode that we recorded a few weeks ago about military culture. You know, she embodies a lot of what we talked about this concept of, so this person goes away to war, they come back wounded physically and mentally, and you know, you think about what they've sacrificed and you don't want to leave this person. You want to be by their side and help them recover. It's the very least they deserve. But when alcoholism takes over, you know, at some point you got to protect yourself and you got to protect your kids, and you've got to honor and respect the fact that you deserve to be treated, you know, nicely and humanely. And staying in that situation is not in either of your best interests necessarily. So, such a tough situation.
Yeah, it is. I don't know if walking away is the only thing, but I don't know how open he is to doing, or if he's getting any therapy through the VA or outside of the VA. I mean, but trying to get someone to understand that, you know, that the drinking is driving a wedge between the relationship, and then obviously he doesn't see the caregiving that she gave, or he doesn't feel that he was caregiven enough, or he would have, you know, I don't know. You just have so many, I'm sure you have so many other mental issues that are from being in the military, just in general, than, you know, having injuries sustained by that. It makes me sad and shocked if there is no follow-up therapy or continuing therapy for mental health for people that have suffered like that when they have sacrificed for the country. So that, I think, is just...
I think there's...
You can't change anybody's mind. They have to come to it on their own.
I think there's two things going on from, you know, a little bit more detail in the email. I think he's accepted all the help that he's willing to accept. Like, I think there was, she said that after one of his rehabs, they asked him to stay and do sober living, and he wasn't interested, or they asked him to extend his stay in rehab and he wasn't interested. So I think, you know, it's not a matter of whether there's more help available. It's a matter of
whether he's willing. It.
You know, we in both our Shout Sobriety group for folks in early sobriety or for who are seeking sobriety, and in our Echoes of Recovery group for the loved ones of alcoholics, we have spent some time recently talking about deflecting and kind of changing the narrative, changing from the issue at hand to, I want to talk about my issue. You know, it's a form of emotional abuse, but really it's a defense mechanism. And when I hear these stories that are very, very much mirror our story of, I'm going to blame you, my spouse, for the deterioration of the marriage. The reason that we alcoholics do that is because if we didn't have that to blame, if I couldn't say it's your fault, Sherry, you're cold, you're distant, you're a bitch, if I didn't have that tool to use, then the only thing I could blame the deterioration of the marriage on is the alcohol. And if I'm not willing and ready to quit, then I can't go there. I can't blame the alcohol because, you know, then the solution is obvious. I've got to stop drinking. Mm-hmm. And my guess is when we meet people who are kind of in and out of sobriety, yeah, okay, you know, I heated it up real good. I went on a bender for a week. Yes, I'll go to rehab, but I don't really want to quit. I don't really think that's the problem. And I can only imagine if you've got the trauma of combat, how easy it would be to think the alcohol is not the problem. The alcohol is the only thing that makes the problem feel at least manageable on a short-term basis. So reaching out and lashing out for something else to blame and your wife being in the path of that seems very, very common and very unfortunate. Pardon me. So I want to put this in the context of our relationship a little bit. So I talk a lot about how I was a high functioning alcoholic, and there is, I think the disease of addiction works the same on everybody. So when I talk about high functioning alcoholism, I'm not trying to say that I'm above the gutter bum. You know, I'm not above the person who gets up and the first thing they do in the morning is drink whiskey. I just haven't fallen that far yet. Like, you know, alcoholism, there are lots of ways to describe what active addiction and recovery are. Probably one of my favorite analogies, visual descriptions is recovery is when you stop digging and you start climbing. And I was fortunate enough to start pretty high up. I think there are people who are born into really dysfunctional alcoholic families where everyone's drinking all the time and there's yelling and screaming and physical violence and all of this stuff. And when you start there, you're starting so low down that ending up living in a gutter isn't so far to fall. I started, yes, my father drank every day. Alcohol was definitely a part of my family, you know, environment, but you know, it wasn't super dysfunctional. It wasn't, there was no physical abuse. It was, you know, a standard middle-class life. There was food, there were clothes, there was school, there were hugs and love and all of that. And so when I talk about high-functioning alcoholism, I started at a place where as my behavior deteriorated and as the alcohol took its toll and the disease progressed, because as we always say, this is a progressive disease. I was digging from a point that was pretty high and elevated. And so when I recognized that I needed to stop digging and start climbing, I hadn't gotten down super low. And so that's what I mean when we talk about high functioning alcoholism. A lot of the people that we meet and work with, they have maintained their jobs. They have maintained their families, maybe by, you know, holding on by a shoestring, but they have maintained their families. They have not had financial collapse. They have had little or no legal problems. And that's kind of the case with us. But, you know, I don't want that to sound aloof or like I think I'm better than anybody else. I'm not. It's just the starting point is different, and otherwise the disease is the same for all of us. Alcoholism is a progressive disease not only for the drinker, but also for the loved one. Do you feel like your behavior and your reaction and your emotions and how this thing affected you progressed as well? Did you change over the, you know, 25 years of my drinking?
Yeah. I mean, alcohol affected me as a bystander, you know, that's referred to as secondhand drinking. You know, I was gaslit and blamed for a lot of things. I was unheard and I felt disrespected. So I became angry and resentful. And my anxiety level was, you know, was growing, so therefore I wasn't the parent that I wanted to be.
Is that the part of that that's making you emotional, is thinking about parenting?
Well, it makes me emotional because I just get so upset when I think about how the partners in the relationship with the addict have to become somebody different. And it's not who they want to be. It's not who they've set out to be. Because you're affected. And even if you detach, you're affected because you don't want to detach.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in a partnership where you aren't connected and close and that's your person. So, it's, you know, overall, it's just heartbreaking.
That's really interesting and kind of striking. If you are the drinker, even if you're in early sobriety and you're experiencing this detachment and you're having the same reaction to it as this gentleman did, you know, blaming your partner for the deterioration of the marriage, I would guarantee you your partner is not doing that, is not pulling away because they want to. And that's, you know, you're kind of lending support for that. That's the last thing you want, is to be a solo parent and to feel like you don't have a connection with the person you married.
Yeah, either you get sucked into the chaos or you start to detach. Yeah. So you're not sucked in as much. And it's still emotional and it's still hard. I feel like it helps me not wear the pain of the relationship or wear your anger, or, you know, I could kind of deflect it a little bit, and I tried to then make us separate people.
Yeah, you know, I've never been in your shoes, but I can imagine you can only wear it for so long. You can only live in that place where you got your sleeves rolled up and you're trying to fix it and you're trying to be careful of everything you say and you're trying not to cause a relapse or you're trying not to cause me to drink more than I already had planned to, and you can only and for your effort you're getting, you know, an unpredictable emotional partner, and you're getting snapped at, and you're getting yelled at, and you're staying up all night fighting. You can only stay in that spot for so long, no matter how bad you want it to get better.
Or it's the opposite, like, you know, the ups and downs. Like, it could be great for a while, and then when it's not great, even if you were drinking, but you weren't snapping at us or being emotionally unreliable and, you know, and things were going well for a while, then it changes. So it's a constant roller coaster of emotion. You don't know what you're getting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I wanted to kind of set the stage with talking about high-functioning alcoholism and the fact that the disease progresses, and we did progress. We just didn't get, you know, all the way down into the gutter, because I have said all along that I didn't lie. I didn't lie about my drinking, and as we have, you know, described, I definitely lied to you and myself, honestly, about how much I was drinking at times. We had, for a few years, we had a kegerator, a little refrigerator with a keg in it. And boy, that is the ultimate tool for self-deceit, because it becomes impossible, or nearly impossible, to count how many beers you've had when you're just pouring it out of the tap. And, you know, I never, like, finished a beer before I poured another one. Every time I walked past the kegerator, I would just top it off. And so, in that situation, which, like I said, was a few years long, but even when I was drinking bottles or cans or drinking vodka or whiskey, you know, I often hid how much I was drinking, but I never hid whether or not I was drinking. And I've always said that the reason I didn't lie about whether or not I was drinking was because I didn't think I could get away with it.
Yeah.
And then I've just kind of left it at that, because we interact with a lot of people where lying is a thing. Lying about whether or not they have been drinking is a thing. And, you know, I just kind of callously assumed that relationships with that lying, which I am going to start calling deceit betrayal, that deceit betrayal trauma and it is trauma, make no mistake about it, is because the liar thought they could get away with it. That's what I've assumed all along. That person thought, I am sneakier than Matt is, and I am a better hider of my intoxication than Matt is, so I'm going to drink and try to fly under the radar. And I'm beginning to question that, that that's really, you know, why it has happened. I'm just not so sure anymore. So I want to kind of dive deeper into that. Let's do a little logic question, Sherry, or, you know, explanation. Alcohol in our relationship, and in most, alcohol led to relationship distress. Relationship distress led to potential for divorce. But the potential for divorce never became imminent. It never became a super strong driver, like in the moment, for me to stop digging and start climbing. There were a few times in our relationship where there were ultimatums. Just a few, though. I think you knew that those were just kind of empty threats. Is that fair to say? I think one of the reasons is that our lives were just so intertwined. We owned a business together. We had kids. We're both on the mortgage. We're thousands of miles from either side of our family out here in Colorado. So I saw the barrier to you leaving as being so high that I never thought I would just come home one day and you wouldn't be here anymore. Is that how you felt? Like, I don't doubt that there were times when you didn't want to be in the relationship anymore, but I never felt like it was an imminent threat, like, she's going to leave.
Yeah, I don't think that I would have done that, like, packed up and left. Like, it would have been, you know, a lot slower process for sure. You know, like, maybe I would get you to move out, but... And I think that our kids wouldn't want to be uprooted, so I was really worried about their stability. But I also knew that I didn't want to live in an alcoholic environment their whole life, and so it was, yeah, it was intertwined and messy, and untangling that would have been hard.
And, you know, honestly, your alternatives weren't super attractive either, because I think, as is often the case, this is not a criticism of you in any way, as is often the case, if you're going to break up the marriage and kind of restart, you're going to need a period of reset where you go back to your family. I mean, I think if I, in my head, thought about what reality would look like if we had gotten divorced, if you had picked up and left, you've talked on the podcast a lot of times about how I'm a follower, I'm a chaser. Boy, I think it would have been tough for you to stay in Denver. Like, if you had just gotten an apartment and moved out on the sly, right, without me knowing, I would have hunted you down. I mean, it would have been ugly.
Yeah.
So I feel like your only chance, if you had gotten that far, would have been to go from Denver back to Indiana with family and kind of let them help you for some period. Does that seem fair?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think...
And that's very unattractive.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm not taking any shots. I'm not trying not to take any shots.
Yeah, but who wants that, you know?
But the idea of going back to that, I think... So, in the back... I can't help but say that in the back of my mind, when I thought about the threat of divorce, it always played that, you know, that's what she's going to have to go through if she really takes that step. And that, I think she finds that pretty unappealing.
Yeah.
There were also good times always, you know, mixed in. I never got to be I was a daily drinker, but I never got to be a daily drunk, right? I never got to the point where every morning I got up and started drinking and I drank all day, or even that I came home every night and I drank until I was obliterated. I was, you know, it was exhausting and it was futile, but I did try to control my drinking, and I tried to, you know, we would go weeks where I'm sure it was unattractive and it wasn't all that great of a situation to live in, but I didn't get like obliterated and cause all kinds of problems. We'd go weeks in between incidents. So sprinkled into the dysfunction was some decent times, maybe even some good times. And so when we talk about the imminent threat of divorce, that's another reason that I never felt that, like, she is 1 foot out the door and she'll be gone tomorrow.
Yeah, it wasn't constant chaos.
Yeah.
And alcoholism, and it wasn't fight after fight after fight after fight. And, you know, I hadn't despised you yet.
Yeah.
Like, just as a human, so.
It's a good way to put that. So for all of those reasons, I didn't feel like divorce was an imminent threat. I didn't feel like it was just right around the corner. Maybe if I had, you know, if we had gotten to the point where I really thought it was, the train was coming down the tracks and it was unavoidable, maybe I would have lied. Maybe it's not a case of I just didn't think I could get away with it. Maybe if lying was a, what I had viewed as a risk for sure, drinking and lying about it while living with you would have been a huge risk, but maybe it would have been a risk I would have been willing to take if I really thought you were leaving and I really, 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 really couldn't quit. I mean, I think that's the differentiator, right? When you did detach effectively, when I would tell you, you know, oh, listen to what I've read about alcohol, or listen to my new rules I just thought of. This is going to be great. This is how I'm going to be able to keep alcohol in my life and keep you in my life. And you had no interest in listening to me. And I really did start to feel that your detachment was becoming more and more, you know, increasingly effective, increasingly consistent. And you just didn't have any interest in me, no matter what I was talking about. When I did feel that, that's what motivated me to quit. But maybe if I had been in maybe if I had been further down, maybe if I had dug further and not started climbing and got to a point where the physical addiction was such that I just couldn't quit no matter what, then maybe lying I would have entertained that as an option.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think you have to go further down and become physically dependent on the substance or chemically dependent on the substance, or to entertain those more unattractive behaviors. I think part of the reason you weren't a liar was that wasn't anything in your family of origin.
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of being responsible, being accountable, taking ownership of your actions. And there was a high level that I think was placed on you and your sister growing up to have these certain standards about yourself and how to treat others. So I think that also helped, that you, it would have taken you a lot further down the line to become a liar. It was part of your identity. And you also for years were trying to convince me that everybody drank like this, because I didn't grow up in a household where drinking was a thing other than it being a social or once in a while event. With the exception of my dad. And then, I had a brother-in-law, so that was alcoholic. So I think that it was a lot, but I can see the further dependent on it, whether it's self-medication, coping skill, as you like to say, maladaptive coping skill.
Coping mechanism.
Yeah. Sorry, I can't remember all your taglines. I think that lying could...
Some of them
were a mouthful. Yeah, lying could be entertained. I think it would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah.
If I was more threatening and you believed the threats.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really think that you believed the threats.
Well, the...
Because threats really, you know, you have to have action behind them and...
Yeah, the ultimatums, I didn't. They were rare.
So,
and you and I both threw those out. You and I both used the divorce word from time to time. I never really believed. You're right. I believed the detachment because it was like, don't believe their words, believe their actions. Like the detachment, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
She has no interest in me in any way.
She doesn't want to hear anything I say.
Yeah. That,
I mean, I didn't get to the point of walking around in with headphones on and listening to other things, which I know some people in their relationships have.
Yes.
But I'm also very good at giving the blank stare, I think, and just looking at a wall behind you.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And then go on.
Yeah. Just waiting for me to finish so you could walk away.
Yeah, not so listening to anything. I just, that's my perspective on maybe why lying wasn't part of the relationship with, like, lying that you were actually drinking. Yes, you were deceitful about some of the amounts.
Yeah.
But you didn't ever try to hide that you were drinking because you felt that it was your right.
Yeah.
And you didn't believe that I was really going to head out. Maybe earlier on if I had said it, but the drinking wasn't as bad. And you didn't become physically addicted to it.
Right. Right. Okay, so we're on the same page with this. I feel like this kind of exploration into why the lying is helpful because, like I said, I have just for so long just callously thought, I didn't lie because I didn't think I could get away with it. And someone who does lie must think they can get away with it and whatever, move on. I think there's kind of more behind it. But even as we acknowledge the fact that maybe someone who does lie and try to hide the fact that they're drinking is hiding bottles and is just bold faced, no, I didn't drink today. You know, that kind of a thing. I think it is from a point of self-preservation. And they might think just like I did from the perspective of, this is really hard to get away with. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get away with it. But I'm willing to take that risk of just lying to her face because the alternative is so much scarier. The alternative is imminent divorce. But even with that kind of analysis, even with that acknowledgement, that's maybe the reason why some of the lying takes place. Even that imminent threat is still not an excuse for lying, in my opinion. And I want to hear your opinion. Because that deceit betrayal, which is what I'm going to call this form of lying from now on, is just devastating. It's way worse than active alcoholism in and of itself. And the reason I'm calling it deceit betrayal is because that word betrayal is so powerful. And I don't think that the liars, I don't think that the alcoholics who are hiding it and telling their spouse that they're not, I don't think they recognize. I know for a fact we know people who say, I did it to protect my spouse. I thought I would hide the fact that I was drinking because I didn't want to hurt her anymore. I don't think they realize that they're hurting them way more by lying to them than they are just by the drinking alone.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Thanks for that follow-up.
Well, also,
I mean, you've heard that the lying is worse than the drinking,
yes,
right?
I have, but also I think you kind of have to think about it from whoever the liar is, from their upbringing. You know, like, that happens a lot. Are they a child of an alcoholic? If they are, more than likely, they are okay with white lies. And then that just grows. And, you know, you tell yourself lies. I mean, that because a lot of us children of alcoholics had a tendency to not always tell the truth. Because you're keeping a secret in your family.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, our daughter admits that she just told some very weird, like, sport that she played to people, and she never did, you know? I think she took, like, a few, like, a summer of lessons of tennis, but she told people that she played tennis in high school instead of saying she played volleyball and soccer, like, people that she had just met.
Just kind of arbitrary
lies. Yeah, she's like, I don't even know why I did it, but I was like, you know, because we try to hide who we are because we grow up in environments where we don't feel good.
Let's talk a little more about that because I have said so many times that one of the things I love the most about you is that you just can't lie. And when on the podcast, if I say something, if I go right and you don't think that's correct and you want to go left, you go left and you correct me. So you don't just kind of go along with things. You very, very consistently tell the truth, even if there's personal, challenges in doing so, even if there are negative effects from telling the truth. And I love that because I never have to, you know, I often have to wonder what you're thinking because you're, you know, you kind of keep it inside sometimes. But if I get you talking, I never have to wonder about whether you're telling me the whole truth or not.
Yeah, but it wasn't always like that in our relationship.
Well, there was, I mean, almost always was. There was one incident.
I'm just going to interject this. I feel like there was lots of times where I avoided telling you my feelings.
Yeah, you stuff.
So I was hiding them, mm-hmm. and I would agree to avoid conflict. So I wasn't being truthful to myself or to you because I wasn't being authentic. So I was hiding that, and I don't know how that qualifies as lying, but, you know, not being truthful to myself.
So that authentic honesty that I get now, that authentic honesty that I love so much, that is part of your recovery and trust building and improvement in the relationship.
Yeah, and I'm not saying like I did it on a daily basis. Also, my face can't hide when I'm disagreeing with you. I'm the big eye roller.
It's great. It's
great. Sire, so.
I mean, it hurts sometimes, but it's great.
So that's kind of hard. But, I mean, there were lots of times where just not being truthful with myself and verbalizing that and into the relationship, I feel like that still qualifies as, you know, also a deceit sort of thing.
There was one time, though, relatively early in our marriage. It was early in our time in Denver, so it was, I don't know, 18 years ago or 17 years ago. You ran up a credit card that was in your name only that I didn't even know you had. And, you know, we had a little financial speed bump to deal with. Mm-hmm. What was that all about?
Well,
that was definitely lying.
Yeah, I had had the credit card for years before we were married. And I had always paid it off. And then it was harder to pay off because you were becoming more in control of the money. And when I say you became in control of the money, you became in control of the finances. Because between the business and the personal, you weren't like doing anything illegal. Sometimes we would have to borrow from our personal savings to pay some business stuff. So you said it would just be easier for you to manage that, trading back and forth of the money. And pardon me, before that I had been able to like cover those expenses on the credit card. And I also felt like you thought I was frivolous because this was a time in our relationship and marriage where finances were becoming a little tighter and mm-hmm. we had more kids and I was buying them things and you would get upset when they would get new clothes or new toys or, you know, just things that I felt like they needed and deserved. I think probably because like I grew up with a single parent who did not get, spousal or child support from, you know, my dad, so her ex-partner, so I didn't want them to go without. Now, this was not like lavish stuff. It was like going to Marshall's or going to Target or Kmart for things. But then it just got harder to pay the bill without you knowing, because I didn't want to have you yell at me for buying things. Because I already, when I would do that with our regular account, you would yell at me. You thought I was just a spendthrift. And they didn't need these things. So, you know, and, you know, then for me, like, I would like to have something new. Your body changes after kids. You're not the same shape, even if you're the same size. So, you just thought that I just felt like you thought that I was, you know, vain and frivolous. So I hid that from you. Because coming to you would have been a lot harder in a lot of ways. And having you tell me those things again, which I already felt like you had told me before, and having you remind me of that was just going to make me more angry with you.
I'm really, really sorry. You and I have not talked about this in...
But we didn't even really talk about it. It was just yelling, and I apologized, and we paid it off. And
but the yelling was because you had lied to me.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when that's why I say this, deceit, betrayal is an appropriate word, because I was so mad. All of that detail you just shared, what it was, spending money on toys and stuff for the kids and stuff for you after having babies, I could not, 3 minutes ago before this topic came up, I could not have told you what you spent that money on, because I was in such a blind rage about having been lied to that I didn't, I'm sure you told me in the moment, but I didn't want to hear that. Like, not in the moment. I'm sure you told me when I figured out that we had this credit card debt to deal with. But I didn't want to hear it. All I could think about was that you had lied to me and hidden that from me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's why towards the beginning of this conversation, and you said, you know, you don't think that you would have... You thought maybe now you're a little bit arrogant saying, oh, I don't think I could lie and get away with it. You had always been so opposed to lying or any mistrust or any information that you weren't receiving that was important. You were so against. So right there, you just said, you know, you were so hurt by this deceit, betrayal of me lying and hiding the credit card.
It didn't matter what it was. You could have bought, you know, a kidney for your mom with that credit card, and I wouldn't have cared. The fact that you didn't tell me is right. All that matters.
So I'm just saying, I think that's why it was so hard for you to try to lie to me about alcohol, because it's just not in you and who you are, no matter what, it would be protected.
Yeah.
Because you, maybe, like, read through the statement, because you opened the mail, mm-hmm. and... You know, and you saw the places of purchase. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, you know, to a sex shop or, you know, anything. So, I don't know. Like,
a sex shop.
Yeah, you know, me and all my...
You weren't buying sex at the sex store.
Sex toys. So, you know, you could look and see what it was spent on.
I mean, I might have been able
to... But it didn't matter. Maybe... Because you were so upset.
Yeah, maybe that was... Maybe looking to see... only would have made it, you know, worse had it been, I don't know, something really frivolous. But that doesn't, I have no memory of what you spent the money on. All I remember is the deceit. And so...
And also, I don't think I ever told you that I had the credit card in my name alone that
yeah.
I had had
oh,
for
I
a while. Because,
yeah.
you know, I just felt like... With my mom and my sister having divorces that were kind of ugly, I didn't have, like, a stash of cash.
Yeah.
But I did at least have that
yeah.
if I needed to run.
Oh, I have such a different perspective on this now. Just right here in this moment, you and I, as we famously tell people, we don't do any prep for the podcast. So I asked you right before we hit the record, can we talk about that credit card thing? But that's literally the first time we've talked about it in probably over a decade, maybe longer. And so it's the first time I've really thought about that was a security blanket for you. And that was a way to avoid an argument about the things you were purchasing.
Yeah, I mean...
And so I am very, 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 very sorry for putting you in a position where you felt like you needed to have it. I'm still, you know... I still a little bit hurt about the fact that there was a lie, but kind of more than that, I have an appreciation for how you needed to and had to do that. And what I want to transition that into is, I don't think that same justification holds when the thinking is I had to lie about my drinking. Because if I didn't, I was going to get divorced. Because there is another option. That other option is to stop drinking. Continuing to drink is not the same as buying necessities for your children. You lied to me And you used that card to buy necessities for our children or buy necessities for yourself after pregnancy. The idea that I have to lie to you, my spouse, because I have to protect my drinking because I can't stop. I'm not denying that stopping drinking is hard. I'm not denying that that's maybe the biggest challenge you'll ever face in your life. But the ends just don't justify the means. Lying to protect you from my drinking or lying so that you won't divorce me because of my drinking. I just don't see a world in which that's the solution is to find a way to quit.
Yeah, I mean,
even if it's nearly impossible.
I think if you
it's not impossible.
Do find yourself in that situation where you find it's impossible to stop drinking. You're physically dependent, but you are lying to your partner so you don't, you know, have to end the marriage or the relationship. I think it's really going to be hard, but being more truthful and saying, I can't physically quit, and then having that desire to want to quit and do everything you can. Now, I didn't want to hear every time you had a craving.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that hard balance. Like, you would scare me when you had tried sobriety before. Like, when you would say, I'm having a craving or I wish I could drink. That would scare me.
Sure.
You know, but, sure. Like, you know, talking about it and being, you know, maybe having some boundaries set up around it, but being able to share that is, I think, and being so vulnerable to your partner, knowing that you have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, instead of lying, like, bring them in to the situation. You don't have to suffocate them. But you can bring them in and say, I can't physically quit, or I can't find a way to stop. And I think it's a level of respect. I feel like you don't respect your partner enough to tell them the truth. Again, don't suffocate them with everything. But be vulnerable and invite them in and have respect that they're going to try to do the best they can to help you. And I know it's not up to us to help them, but we could help find resources, or we could brainstorm to try to come up with some other ideas, because all of us partners, most of us partners have done that. And I just feel like sometimes we hear stories of the addict just swatting away all the ideas that the partner has, but also it has to come from the addict to want to do better.
Yeah, that honesty, that vulnerability is really, really, really hard for a lot of people. You talked about, you know, family of origin and how you were brought up and how I was brought up and how that translated into our marriage. I think for a lot of people, they were brought up not to talk about anything ever. And so the idea of going there in your marriage when you're facing this huge demon, I mean, it's almost too big of a hurdle to get over. The listener asked, do they ever come back? And kind of inherent in that, since she's married to that person, do the relationships ever come back? And the answer is kind of a resounding yes. Sometimes the alcoholic gets sober and finds recovery. Sometimes the relationship survives and recovers and starts to flourish. And from what we've seen, deceit betrayal is not a determining factor in whether or not recovery can take place and whether or not the person can come back. So, we know people we are, you know, in contact with and have friendships with couples where lying and hiding of alcohol was a big part of the story. Was again, deceit betrayal was the kind of most significant part of the story. And they are getting both individual recovery on track and also the relationship recovery on track. So it's not, you know, it would be maybe easier to say, oh, once you've crossed that bridge, there's no coming back. That's just not the case. We know people where there was no lying and they can't, their relationship is not improving. There's no recovery. And we know people where there was lying and the relationship is improving. There is recovery. So it's not a determining factor on whether or not you can come back from it. But it does make it a lot harder.
Yeah.
That deceit betrayal is an extremely difficult thing to come back from.
Well, and I think for me, there's, as we've like kind of worked through these processes with people and hear stories about lying and then that, like, when we hear these words in the recovery world of ownership, accountability, responsibility, I think some of them can get all marred together, and they, people can think, well, I admit that I did that. I admit that I lied. I admit that I hid drinking. I admit that I was, pardon me, hateful with my words. I admit that I was emotionally abusive. Okay, so that, to me, is taking accountability of it, you know? But there's a difference in, like, having responsibility and ownership. And I think it's Laura McCallum that says, you know, it's not your responsibility, or what...
It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
So, yeah. So, like, yeah, alcoholism and the disease of it isn't your fault, but fixing it is your responsibility. Or that goes for anybody else. Like, we've used those lines on people we know that need recovery from being a victim of alcoholism. You know, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility to take care of those actions. There's also the ownership piece. So, for me, like, the ownership piece is acknowledging that, yes, you did those things, but then jumping in and learning to fix them, like using that as the responsibility, but looking at it as like accountability. Yep, that's my job. I admit that I did that. Ownership is like, yeah, I did that, but how is this going to get resolved? How can I work to fix it? How can, I don't know. I feel like there's, because some people lump all that together because they are so similar, but I think there's different layers of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm glad you explained that.
Because I will admit, I did kind of look it up because I feel like for the last like 6 months, I've kind of wrestled with what is the difference between accountability, responsibility, ownership, all those pieces, you know, because sometimes I am at my work and I'm like, well, that's not my job. And then I'm like, that's kind of shitty because I'm like in my job outside of our nonprofit. I do a lot of things in the building. And so I said that and somebody called me on it and I was like, yeah, I'm going to kind of look into it. Am I going to have accountability for my pieces of it, or am I going to have ownership of my job and then it entails other bits of the building?
Yeah.
So since then I kind of have been wrestling, but I did.
No, it's good.
I think that it really is a way that we can translate that and help. And I think for us partners, it's great that you acknowledge that you've done those things. Okay? It's like, we don't want a blanket apology. We appreciate that you're being accountable for those actions.
Right.
But then just saying, I told you I did that. I know. But then that ownership of like, try to work on it together and learn to see it from their side, that there needs to be a little bit more than just being accountable for it.
Speaking of ownership, I want to own my hypocrisy. Because there is one area where I do think, I actually promote lying in one area. And that is in early sobriety when, you know, our recommendation to people is in that first year of sobriety, avoid social interaction. Do everything you can to avoid social interaction. But there are those kind of required things, a required work event or Christmas with the family, like, you know, something you just can't get out of. You've got to be a part of. And I do, for someone from your side of the fence, Sherry, for someone who's never been an alcoholic, you can't imagine what it's like to be in a social situation where for 20 years you've been kind of the life of the party person and all of a sudden you're not drinking. You can't imagine the pressure and the shame and the stigma that is on you when you're not drinking in that situation. And so I have promoted many times, have a half a dozen little white lies in your pocket that you can use. I've got to go to the airport and pick up my daughter in an hour, or I'm on medication, or I just haven't been feeling well, or I've got a big presentation at work tomorrow and I need to be sharp for it. Have things you can say so that when the the host of the party offers you a drink for the fourth time, even though you've said you're not drinking that night, you can get them off your back. And so that is the one area. That's the only area I can think of where I think a little white lie is your best option. Otherwise, you know, the last thing that comes back in relationship recovery is trust and intimacy. And trust is 100% about not just honesty, but anticipation of honesty. Honesty is one, just like you just parsed ownership and accountability. Honesty is one thing, but trust is not only do I trust that this person is being honest with me, but I also trust that they're going to continue to be honest with me. So that anticipation of honesty has to be there. And this deceit betrayal that we've been talking about, it's the ultimate enemy of both honesty and the anticipation of honesty. So deceit betrayal is the enemy of trust. So, you know, I mean, I sound like I'm like, I don't know, holier than thou, right? But I think honesty when talking to our kids about alcohol and other drugs and sex is really important. If you ignore it and hope it goes away, that's not going to help your kids at all. I think honesty in dealing with the transgressions of alcoholism is really important. Saying things like, oh, that was in the past. I'm sober now. I don't want to talk about that. That is not going to work through the resentments. You can't live that way. So you got to go there. You got to be honest and deal with the stuff that's happened. And honesty in marriage, I just think is so important. One of the big lessons for me in recovery has been, you know, that marriage isn't this Disney version of unconditional love. Unconditional love is reserved for very few relationships, certainly the parent-child relationship. I have unconditional love for my kids. No matter what they do, I will always love them, and I know you feel the same way. You also have that for your cats, which is nice. It's nice for your cats. But we don't have...
Is it okay to say I don't have unconditional love for teenage boys on a snow day when I'm trying to work and you're trying to work and all they can do is bicker?
Your unconditional love for your kids does wane at times. It does get tested.
I'm teasing. Of course, I'll always love them.
But you don't
have... Don't always have to like them.
You don't have unconditional love for me. The marriage love is very much conditional love. I have to keep reinventing this safe environment. Honesty is foundational. I think anyone who thinks marriage is unconditional love is crazy. If I went out and had sex with 10 people and came and told you about it and said, yeah, but you got to still love me and stay with me, I mean, that's crazy. Marriage is the ultimate example of conditional love. I've brought things into the relationship. You've brought things into the relationship. And we have to continue for the rest of our lives to keep holding up our end of the bargain. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, that is a condition, then we can stay in love and stay together. And for me, what I've learned in recovery and what I've learned from all these wonderful people that we get to know is from your side of the fence, how important that safe, trustworthy, honest environment is. I never thought of marriage, the key to marriage is safety, but it is. And I'm not talking about physical safety. I'm not talking about just not beating you. That's not enough to create safety. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to tell me about the things you want to spend money on for the kids and yourself because they're important and you know I'm not going to fly off the handle and reject your opinion on that. That's what safety is all about. And so deceit, betrayal is just a trauma that there's no place for in the marriage. And, you know, if you're weighing... If the decision is between do I lie to keep me from getting divorced or do I tell the truth about this horrible thing that I'm having trouble dealing with, I think the truth's always got to win. Because the lying, as we've learned from so many folks, is just so much worse.
And also, sometimes we make up worse stories in our head, and if the truth is, sometimes can be a lot less painful than the stories we're making up in our head.
That's true too. Well, I've adopted this mindset where I'm just treating our marriage like the world's longest first date. Before you go, we hope you'll consider these three resources.
If you love or loved an alcoholic, we offer support and connection in our Echoes of Recovery group. Check us out at echoesofrecovery.org.
If you are a high-functioning alcoholic seeking methods and connection in early sobriety, we're ready for you at shoutsobriety.org.
No matter who you are, there's something for you in our book, Sober Evolution, Evolve into Sobriety and Recover Your Alcoholic Marriage. Go to soberevolution.org.
For my wife, Sherry Salas, I'm Matt Salas. Thanks for listening to the Untoxicated Podcast.